How many of you have ever inherited something from a relative? All right. Or maybe a grandparent or a parent who died, and in his or her will, they instructed that something be given to you. Well, have you ever been in a situation where a parent or a grandparent died and they intended to leave you something, but your brother or sister would not let you have it? Maybe your sibling was the primary caretaker of your mom in her fading years. When your mom died, your sibling claimed everything that mom left, including what she left to you. Maybe it was something relatively small, like the dishware that had been grandma's. Or maybe a collection of music that mom was fond of. But maybe it was something a little more significant. Perhaps a large sum of money. Her 2014 Jeep Grand Cherokee. Maybe even her house. And your sibling will not give it over to you. Your sibling will not hand over to you what is rightfully yours. And tell me, how do you think you'd respond to your sibling? Well, I can tell you how most Americans would respond. I'll see you in court. I'm going to call my lawyer. Well, take your Bibles and turn with me to Luke chapter 12 this morning, because in Luke chapter 12, verse 13, we read about someone whose sibling was doing exactly what we're describing. His brother would not share the inheritance with him. Just give me a moment to find that, unless most of you probably already have. But begin in verse 13, then one from the crowd said to Jesus, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me." Now, a question we might ask is, why is he telling this to Jesus? Well, this man expects Jesus, as a well-known Jewish rabbi, very well-known at this point, everyone knows him, he expects him to do something for him like other rabbis would often do. You may not realize this, but with their knowledge of the law, rabbis would have some legal ability to pronounce a ruling in cases like this. Especially to force the brother, in this case, to abide by the Jewish inheritance laws. So this man comes to Jesus with the assumption that Jesus would essentially take up his case and see to it that he got his portion of the inheritance. But this man is about to discover that Jesus is not your typical rabbi. You continue reading in verse 14, Jesus' response. Jesus said to him, "Man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" Now, this is another of Jesus' rhetorical questions he loves to use. Here's another way we could ask this question. Who has made Jesus the kind of person that handles people's arguments over who gets what stuff? Is Jesus some kind of umpire that makes sure everyone gets their fair share of money or stuff in this life? Is that one of the reasons that Jesus was sent from the Father to this earth? Absolutely not. So when Jesus asks the question, "Who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you?" what's the answer? Nobody. That's not my job. It has nothing to do with the purpose for why I came. Now, I know that one day Jesus will be the just judge. He will rule with righteous judgments. It's going to happen. But this time on the earth, that's not what he's here for. In fact, as we keep reading in verse 15, not only does Jesus refuse to do what this man wants him to do, Jesus actually warns that there is something about this man's desire that is actually wrong. Verse 15, he says to them, "Take heed Right? He's opening this beyond just this man. He's opening his conversation to everyone who's there. He says, take heed and beware of covetousness. Tell me something. What is covetousness? Well, according to the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, which many of us go to when we don't know what a word means, covetousness is an inordinate desire for wealth or possessions or for another's possessions. In other words, it's a desire for wealth or possessions that exceeds what is reasonable. And certainly every Jew would have known what God's law said about covetousness. It's the last commandment of the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. And you have to realize that this is long before the big box stores like Walmart and Meijer, long before internet shopping. You know, right now we go into those stores and we don't really point to a certain person that says they own this. They say, yeah, it's the stores. It doesn't belong to anyone. It's just there. Well, you have to realize that in the mind of God, everything belongs to someone. And even back then, there was an identifiable owner that belonged to this object, this object belonged to. So God's command here is not just things that happen to be in your neighbor's house or in your neighbor's driveway. This is a broad blanket statement. So God's command covers everything possible that a person might covet, that a person might strongly desire. So when you and I, for instance, see ads or commercials or featured items on display in the mall intended to get your attention, and there begins to stir inside of you a strong desire for that item to be yours, that's the kind of desire that Jesus is warning about here in verse 15. And don't miss what else Jesus is including in his definition of covetousness. What else does Jesus include in these verses? And we just read it. Jesus includes the strong desire of this man who wanted his brother to give him something that was rightfully his. I'm assuming that that's why he wanted this part of the inheritance, because it belonged to him. It was in Dad's will. Divide it with me. And Jesus is pointing out the hard issue here. That's covetousness. Jesus is implying that even for a person to have such strong desires for something that even rightfully belongs to him is also a form of covetousness. And Jesus refuses to help this man get the money or the possessions that he has this strong desire for. But wait a second. Isn't it wrong? Wasn't it wrong for this man's brother to withhold his share of the inheritance? Absolutely. We're not denying that. Of course it's wrong. We'd probably even call it theft. But is Jesus dealing with the wrongness of his brother's theft at this moment? He's not dealing with that. That's a whole other issue. He is dealing with the wrongness of the response of the man who had been wronged. And Jesus warns him and everyone else standing there listening to him to be on guard against this strong desire for wealth or possessions, regardless of whether or not it rightfully belongs to them or not. And Jesus stresses the danger of this kind of desire and how he warns not once, but twice against it. He says, take heed. He also says, beware. If you're using a New King James translation like I have this morning, you'll notice that next to the word covetousness is a little number. And some of you probably just raise right over those numbers. Some of you are like, oh, so what do these numbers and these letters mean? Well, if you have a New King James translation, there's a footnote on the bottom of your page that includes a little three-letter word here next to the word covetousness. And some of you with newer translations actually has it right there in the text. What's this three-letter word that starts with letter A? It's the word all. In other words, it's not just one form of covetousness that Jesus is after here. It's all forms of covetousness. It's every kind of covetousness. And Jesus says, be on guard against it. Which means guarding against coveting what belongs to your neighbor, right? 10th commandment. It includes guarding against coveting what you might see in the store or on the internet, something that doesn't necessarily seem to have an owner attached to it. It includes guarding against coveting even something that rightfully belongs to you. All forms of covetousness we need to be on guard against. Which brings us to the critical truth that you and I need to get our minds wrapped around this morning. Look at the end of verse 15, and I want you to give me Jesus' answer to this question I'm about to ask. Here's the question. Why do you and I need to be on our guard against all forms of covetousness? What does it say? Why? Because for what? One's life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. One's life does not consist in the abundance of the things that you or I possess. My friend, you need to grab hold of these words as tightly as you can. Because this is a declaration of Jesus himself about your life and mine. A person's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. Do you understand what Jesus is saying here? Jesus is making it clear to everyone who is listening, he is opening this wide open to everyone standing there before him, that accumulating possessions and wealth to yourself is not what life is all about. Now maybe some of us sitting here this morning might have a bit of a problem with the words of Jesus. Because your experience of life thus far looks like that's what life is all about. I mean, that's how your friends live. That's how your coworkers live. That's how your neighbors live. That's probably how some of your family members live. That's the message that you get from social media and from ads and commercials. So from your point of view, maybe getting a newer phone, getting a newer car, getting the next step up in kitchen conveniences, whatever newest, next best thing it may be for you, that's all that life is all about. That's exactly, in your estimation, what everyone lives for. I interned at a Christian camp in California for 2 years. I remember one Christmas flying home for Christmas break. I was actually dating Megan at the time. And I had a layover in Phoenix for about 8 hours. So I was planning to do what most college kids would do, just camp out there at the airport for 8 hours, find a patch of carpet and try to catch a wink or something. But on the way to Phoenix on the airplane, I was sitting across the plane from a nice Catholic couple who actually offered to put me up for the night. Their brother was staying with them for 8 hours, and he was coming right back to the airport. They said, hey, why don't you just come home with us, and we'll take you right back. And I was thinking, you know, this is gospel opportunity. And so I accepted. We get in the car, pull up to the gate to pay the parking ticket, happen to see that in this lady's wallet, it was packed with $100 bills. So apparently this couple was pretty wealthy. I get to their house, which was a gorgeous two-story house, easily worth $500,000 today, which they said was their second home. Their first one was in Minnesota. We get inside, they get their Crown Cokes, I get my regular Coke, and then they began to look at ads in the paper. And guess what they're looking at? Homes for sale. From my perspective, the accumulation of possessions to themselves seemed to be what their life consisted of. The accumulation of houses. The accumulation of money to buy more houses. The accumulation of possessions to furnish those houses. From my perspective, that seemed to be their life. The question is that our life? Now, you and I would say, well, not like that. But is that the life of those who call themselves the people of God? Does our life in any way, as professing Christians, resemble this pursuit of wealth and possessions for ourselves? As we continue on to verse 16, we realize that Jesus isn't done confronting this covetous way of thinking and living. Jesus is going to show us just how worthless this way of life really is. And he does so in the form of a parable. It's been a little while since we looked at a parable. If you don't remember what a parable does, what a parable is, you could essentially say a parable is an earthly story with a kingdom meaning or a heavenly meaning. Anytime you see Jesus telling people a parable, that should make you think, aha, there's a lesson here for me. Sometimes that lesson's a positive one, right? Matthew 13:44, Jesus says, for example, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and he hid, and for joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys that field. Next verse there, Matthew 13:45-46, he says, again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking beautiful pearls, who when he found the one pearl of great price, sold all that he had, and he bought it. And these are beautiful kingdom truths about the value of the kingdom. That it's worth everything in order to get. That's great. That's awesome. That's beautiful. However, in this parable, in Luke 12, beginning in verse 16, it's not one of those positive parables. Yet it too will have a kingdom meaning that Jesus wants us to understand. So let's begin reading this parable here, and I want you to work very hard to understand the kingdom meaning that this story holds for us. Begins in verse 16, a ground of a certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, what shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops? So let's stop right here. Let's look at a few things. First of all, how is this man described? What kind of man is he? He is a rich man, which means he's a man with a significant amount of wealth at his disposal, probably an overabundance of possessions, right? He has more than he needs, more than he possibly could do with. That's typically how we define rich, right? He's not scraping the bottom of the barrel, in other words. Secondly, this story tells us that his land produced plentifully. In fact, things have gone so well that he can't fit everything into his storehouses. I don't know if any of you have gone grocery shopping recently. You probably have. My wife reminds me every day when she goes grocery shopping. But in today's farming industry, with the food supply shortages going on around the world, you know, bird flu going on amongst our chickens, this would seem to be a good problem to have that this man has. I can't fit it all. So what would you do if you are rich and you didn't have enough space to store everything that you've grown? At my house, I have one of those tough sheds that you buy at Home Depot. It's probably 8 feet wide, 10 feet deep. When we bought our house about 3 years ago, that shed was the perfect size for us. You know, I could put my tools in there, I could put my camping supplies in there, I could put my lawnmower and my weed whacker in there. But probably like you, I've made this discovery 3 years later, my 8x10 tough shed has a lot more stuff in there than there used to be. Can you relate to that? If you were to open your shed or your garage, you're like, how did this all get here? So what do you do if you have money in the bank and you've run out of room for your stuff? Well, obviously, you tear down your garage and you build a bigger one, right? Well, that's what he did. He built a bigger place, or at least that was his intention, to build a bigger place where he could keep all his stuff. He had run out of room for his crops, so this man came to the same conclusion that most people in our world would. He says in verse 18, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater. And there I will store all my crops and my goods. This is an all-in-one package. Everything is going into this new building that I'm going to build. But as we read in the next verse, I want you to notice specifically why he is planning to build bigger barns and store all his grain and goods there. Right, because this is the pivotal issue, is the why. What is the goal of this rich man's life? He says in verse 19, and I will say to my soul, soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry. What's his goal? His goal is to build bigger barns, to store in those barns all of his sources of wealth, so that he can sit back for many years and live a life that is focused on himself. Isn't that what you see? Is that what it says there? That's what it says. I will be able to kick up my feet and relax. I will be able to take my fill of food and drink. I will be able to have myself a grand old time for many years. I can picture it all now. I have the resources to do it. And I'm going to make this plan of future self-pleasure and self-satisfaction a reality. Starting tomorrow, those old barns, they're coming down, in order to make way for a future completely focused on me. Is that something that some of us would do? Now, probably none of us would admit that. But if you were in this man's shoes, with all of his wealth and resources, and you had the opportunity to build a future that allowed you to live a life of self-comfort and self-pleasure for the rest of your life, isn't that what you'd do? Might require a bit of work at first, right? Pulling down barns takes effort. Building barns takes effort. But doesn't a life of luxury and enjoyment of everything that money can buy sound like it would be worth it? Most of your neighbors think that way. I can't tell you how many times I've heard my neighbors talk about what they'd do if they won the big lotteries that we have. Most Americans think that way. But I wonder how many of us in this room, to some extent, might think that way. How many times that thought slips into there and says, I wonder what I would do with $1 million. Or $10 million, or $100 million, or $1 billion. What would I do? How many of us think or perhaps have even pursued paths or jobs that will hopefully one day allow us to spend the later years of our life just focused on us? Well, Pastor Judd, you don't know how many years I've poured into my job. I gave and I gave and I gave. And some of you, you know, you've gave and you gave and you gave. You poured it all out for this company. They ate you up for the last 30 years. I deserve everything that I've gained. I deserve everything that I've worked for. I deserve to finally live my life for myself for a change. Isn't that what our society works for? Isn't that what the American dream is all about? You work hard, you do your time, and you can make a good life for yourself. But my friend, I need to tell you something. In fact, it's my obligation as your pastor to tell you something. If this is the way that you think, if this is the way that you live, if the goal of your life is to be able to acquire enough wealth and possessions so that you can finally live life for yourself, my friend, you are a fool. You are a fool. That's what God says. This rich man in Jesus' parable, seeing the bumper crop that he had gained, he essentially says, I've got it made. My contribution to society is done. I can now sit back for many years and focus completely on me. And what does God tell him? What does God call him in verse 20? I'm not using strong language here. I'm just saying what God is saying. What does he call him in verse 20? God said to him what? Fool. And why does God view someone as a fool for seeking after a future that is spent on oneself? Let me summarize God's reason in one word. Death. That's the reason that God views someone as a fool for seeking a future spent on oneself. It's because of death. The Lord goes on to say to this rich man, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided? My friends, you do not know the day or the hour that your soul will be required of you. You do not know the day or the hour that you are going to die. The rich man of this story hadn't even torn down a single board of his old barns. Did you realize that? This is all in his mind. But even the self-seeking and self-pleasing plans that he had crafted together in his mind was deserving of God's labeling him as a fool. His day of death had arrived. Remember that this rich man's land had produced a bountiful harvest? Guess what? He wasn't even going to enjoy one grain of it, because it was going to someone else. And all of his wealth, all of his produce, everything that he had spent his life up to that moment for, and everything that he intended to store up for a future spent on himself, it was all about to become the possessions of somebody else. And listen carefully to Jesus' final words for us this morning, verse 21. So is he. What is he? A fool is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God. The earthly story of the rich man is done at this point. But here in verse 21, we discover the kingdom meaning that Jesus has for us. And the meaning is this: if you lay up treasure for yourself, like this rich man of the story intended to do, if you give your life to the accumulating of possessions and wealth with the purpose of using it for your own self-pleasure, and you do not live a life that is rich toward God, my friend, you are a fool. Because death is going to take it all away. And all the preparation that you have done for yourself, all the hard years of labor that you've given to your employer, it's all going to end up benefiting someone else. My friend, I beg you, do not live chasing the higher pay raise, chasing the greater comforts of this life, because you do not know when the light of this life will suddenly come to an end. It'll be over. All you've worked for, gone. Do not waste your life pursuing wealth and possessions. Life does not consist in the abundance of possessions. Do not live this life foolishly by laying up temporary treasures for yourself. There is another way of life that Jesus calls you and I to live that far surpasses anything that this world has to offer. And by God's grace, we will see what that way of life is in greater detail when we return next Sunday.